أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمخلوقين سيدنا ونبينا وشفينا أبو القاسم محمد صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. Sisters and brothers, assalamu alaikum. This is our third session and my last session this Muharram. Just to recap very quickly, in the first talk we tried to understand how history can become quite a powerful force and how one can try to hypothesize how historic events happen and why they happen. And towards the end of that lecture, we came to the idea that there was, in the process of bringing Islam and the personality of the Prophet himself, there was a change in the historic process. And the Prophet transformed a basically tribal society into one based on faith and piety. So preference and honor accrued to people who had faith, not because they were from particular tribes or particular clans or they were rich or they were poor. Yesterday we saw how this basic transformation was challenged essentially by the Banu Umayyah in general and Muawiyah in particular. And we saw that towards the end of his life he had reversed the process again. He had basically reverted back to an essentially tribal culture. And by appointing Yazid, who by universal agreement had no semblance of piety or even outward practice of Islam, he tried to show that really this was superfluous as well as far as rulership was concerned. And so he went back to the system which prevailed before the Prophet. So there was becoming an order in which, if they had succeeded without any challenge, it would have been as if the Prophet never came. And this was essentially what was the dilemma of Imam Hussein. We saw some of the wars which were fought by Muawiyah against Imam Ali, essentially trying to destabilize him. And just when things were becoming a little bit more settled, then Imam Ali alayhi salam was assassinated and Muawiyah made his pitch for the caliphate. Now we remember that Muawiyah became caliph in 661, and for 15 years until 676 he ruled the place. And he spread, as we discussed yesterday again, this vile propaganda against Imam Ali to the extent that everywhere in the Azan and everywhere there was condemnation of Imam Ali mentioned across the Muslim domain. After 15 years, in 676, he nominated Yazid as his heir apparent. And it was after 4 years of that 680, that Muawiyah died. So there were 4 years in which there was propaganda that Yazid was actually now destined to succeed Muawiyah. And everybody knew Yazid, so it was clear what was coming. It wasn't as if that Yazid was appointed on the deathbed of Maria, it was now clear that he was being prepared, and we saw some of the factors which led to the appointment of Yazid. So not only Imam Hussein, but the whole Muslim community of that time had time to think through this process. And Yazid, being what he was, in the very first move he did was to send a messenger to Imam Hussein and seek allegiance and acceptance of his caliphate. 680, Muawiyah dies, and Karbala is also happening in 680. So there is really very little time he lost, if you like, in doing that. Now, as we said, in the meantime, in the last 4 years, with Iraq being controlled by Ziyad ibn Abi, the people of Iraq now felt that we are going to be forever dominated by these rulers from Syria who have no semblance of Islam in them. And the people of Makkah and Medina also started to feel that if nothing was done, then really Makkah and Medina itself would become irrelevant and the whole thing will become something other than what they had felt was the Prophet's mission. And we are looking at something like 50 years after the passing away of the Prophet. So you can see that in that time, most of the companions of the Prophet had started to pass away and very few were remaining. So there was really anxiety that if nothing is done, then nothing will be done and things will fall into disrepair. So on the one hand, there was this thinking on the part of people like Imam Hussein that something needs to be done. There were other people as well. One interesting person whom we will see a bit later was the son of Zubair, Abdullah ibn Zubair. Now you would recall that Zubair and Talha, they fought against Imam Ali in Siffin with Aisha. And so essentially at that time they had taken sides with Muawiyah. But Zubair and Abdullah ibn Zubair never gave allegiance to Muawiyah, his son. Although they fought on that side, they did not give allegiance to Muawiyah. Because they felt that they were more entitled to the caliphate than Muawiyah himself. And so they had this residual idea. And now they started to make propaganda in Medina itself, that we would be prepared, I would be prepared, Abdullah ibn Zubair, to stand as caliph against Yazid, if necessary. To give you an idea of something we will revert back towards the end of this session, we may think that this kind of propaganda which was unleashed by Muawiyah and the Umayyads against Imam Ali was not powerful enough. But if you go back to the sources and examine the sources, narratives of that time, you will see that for a full 150 years after that, most of the sources do not even mention Imam Ali as the fourth caliph. He was airbrushed out of history altogether. So people would just go straight from Uthman to Muawiyah. And that's it. And I will discuss this later, but this just gives you an idea that why for 150 years things spread without any context as to what was happening and what happened after the 150 years. And this is essentially the problem of Sunni theology at that time, because you will remember that after 150 years is the main time when the hadith of the Prophet started to be collected and distributed and disseminated. Now, if at that time the main narrative is itself faulty, then something had to be done. And we will see how that gap was filled mostly in Sunni sources. But to come back here, as soon as this appointment of Yazid was made, not the death of Muawiyah, a lot of people in Iraq started to put feelers to Imam Hussein that the time has come for the family and the true heirs of the Prophet to come forward, and we are more than willing to support you. And as the period went on and closer to Muawiyah's death, these had become like a torrent. Hundreds, and some of them say thousands, of letters were coming in, messengers coming in, that we are waiting. We are waiting for you to take the lead. And in fact, in interpreting the whole movement of the Imam towards Karbala, we have two dominant narratives at the moment. The first one suggests that the Imam had foreknowledge and therefore he was really moving towards his destiny as dictated. This has been challenged by a person in Iran, this is before the revolution, called Salehi Najafabadi. Najafabadi has written a book which is called Shahid Javid, which means the living Shahid, in which he suggests that you do not need to assume foreknowledge of any kind. This is a normal standard process, that somebody of the Imam's caliber and standing and reputation receives hundreds of requests or thousands of requests from sincere, what purports to be sincere followers. And seeing what kind of person Muawiyah has appointed, it is here apparent, and where things are going, there is no alternative but to go and answer that call. And that is why there was this movement towards Makkah and then towards Kufa. And of course, that from that on, the narrative is clear for us, and we have all the Maqtal and everything to say what happened. And you see in the Maqtal several people telling the Imam that, are you sure? We don't really think that all these letters have substance. We are a bit worried. Lots of people coming and saying, you know these people, I know these people, I have met them, I have lived with them, and they have never kept their word, and this and that. But from all the narratives which are there in Abu Miknaf and others, you can see that he doesn't pay heed to that. He says that I have to do my duty. So maybe there is a higher purpose in the sense of demonstrating a principle against this kind of thing. And so in this process, he goes towards Iraq, is cornered, and the whole entourage is massacred and imprisoned and taken to those who survive, especially the women and children, are taken to Damascus as prisoners to the court of Yazid. It's interesting to see that in the court of Yazid itself, in Damascus itself, you find in narratives that people in the street do not react in any significant way against parading the family of the Prophet. Now, this shows you that there is something happening here. They do not know what it is. And I was this morning talking to, we had a guest from Nigeria and she was here yesterday. She has gone today. I was telling her that, she was saying to me, this is all news to me. I said to her, in this day and age, she said, yes. We fast on the 9th and 10th of Muharram. We think because, and there are lots of other events connected with this, like the Ark of Noah came to rest on this day, and Khizr did this, and Moses did this, and lots of other events. So they say it's better to fast on 9th and 10th. But by putting those things forward, this whole narrative has never been explained to them at all. They have no idea of what happened in Karbala. This is today, not at that time. And this is West Africa, where the majority of people are Muslims. So if today nobody has heard about it there, in those times, they would have heard something else, and we come to that. So you see, in Damascus, there is quite an interesting scenario where you are parading people essentially without hijab and so on. In that society, this is degrading. This is done to, you know, captives and slaves and so on. And people don't realize that this is the family of the Prophet. They don't care. They don't understand the implication of that. And this takes you to the next step, that in 2 years after Karbala, Yazid dies suddenly. His reign was only 3 years. Now who takes over? The person who takes over is again in that Umayyad line. His name is Marwan. So again another Umayyad takes over. And then very quickly Marwan is succeeded by his son, Abdul Malik bin Marwan, who rules for about 20 years. So you can see 20 years after Karbala, the reins are still firmly in the hand of Umayyads. Whatever their differences internally, they were not interested at all in opening this chapter that they had done anything wrong. They continued to keep that narrative as it was and spread that vilification of Imam Ali and the Ahlul Bayt across the place. So he takes over in 685, and this kind of propaganda is proceeding everywhere except in Iraq itself. The people who had deserted Imam Hussein at the last moment in Kufa and others, they begin to feel remorse. And they are called Tawwabun and all kinds of other epithets. And they are mobilized by a person called Mukhtar. Mukhtar is not a follower of Imam Hussein. He was more interested in getting Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, who is also on that chart, as a leader. The interesting thing about Mukhtar is that for the first time, most of his supporters and his rank and file, if you like, came from the non-top level of Arab society. They were Mawalis, they were sort of bonded laborers and other things. And he really shook the place in Iraq. And a systematic campaign of assassination of people who participated against the Imam in Karbala and so on, just try to teach them a lesson. But in 2 years, it petered out. He didn't get anywhere. Abdul Malik bin Marwan was able to establish control. The only problem remaining for Abdul Malik bin Marwan after the massacre of Karbala was Abdullah ibn Zubair in Medina. And from 685 to 692, 7 years, he had to fight the people of Medina to establish control. And finally, Abdullah ibn Zubair was killed and defeated in 692. So then now Marwan has complete control. So now you can see that despite the changes, the structure remains intact. The Umayyads are still in control. They have suppressed everything. And the narrative of Muawiyah against Imam Ali and his family continues. In this situation, there are interesting angles which come out. The first one is that, given the situation in Damascus and elsewhere, the remaining family of the Ahlul Bayt in the leadership of Imam Zain al-Abidin were really not in a position to say anything. You see, there was no support on the street and there was oppression from the leadership. So it is quite clear to me that it is in this situation that they invented or came to the idea of organizing mourning ceremonies for what had happened to their family. It's clear that very few people could stop them from, you know, mourning their relatives. I mean, other people say, what's wrong with you? Let them mourn. And slowly they developed that into building an alternative narrative as to what had happened. And by ripples, this started to follow through. And as the movement of Mukhtar and others started, then more and more people started to have this kind of repeat mourning sessions in their own environments and communities and so on. And it's like a ripple effect. But that is a very limited effect. But that was the only way which could find itself to break out from the control which the Umayyads had on the whole structure. But what it did was to destroy the legitimacy of the Umayyads in the core lands of Islam. And people started to question again and think through and say we need to do something. And eventually, after a build-up of several years, this led to the Abbasid revolution. When the Abbasids, they came in the name of avenging the blood of the Ahlul Bayt against the Umayyads and overthrew the Umayyads. Now you would have thought that would have again opened the gates for the true narrative to go forward. But two things happened. One is that the Umayyads, the remaining of them, when they fled across North Africa and into Spain. So that by 711, as we know, they were in Spain, and then they followed through. So the whole of the North African and Spanish understanding of Islam came from the Umayyads, who were on their way out. And of course they were spreading false narrative. They were saying essentially, this people essentially wanted to create fitna in the Ummah by not giving allegiance to Yazid, who was the properly appointed heir of Muawiyah, and therefore we had to fight them, and thank God we managed to finish that fitna. And if you even go to Morocco to this day, on Ashura they have a big celebration and they call it the end of the fitna. Now this is only now specific to Morocco, because the rest of North Africa later on came under Fatimid rule, and so they cling that narrative. On the other side, very soon the Abbasids came into clash with the Ahlul Bayt, as we know, Mahmud Rashid, Harun Rashid and all these fellows. So they did not put enough effort to stop that narrative. And as we said, for 100 years, 150 years nearly, even the idea that Imam Ali had been accepted as a fourth caliph was not in the narratives, not in the books. At the end of that, the Sunni theologians in Baghdad came to an idea of how to solve this puzzle. Because you can see the puzzle is that if you accept that Imam Ali was the rightful caliph, fourth, then you have to accept that Muawiyah was wrong. And so you can't say both are right. If you say accept that Imam Ali was right, then you can't say Tala and Zubair and Aisha were right at the same time, on that time. Now I showed you yesterday by reading that Ibn Khaldun says both were right and nobody was wrong, at this kind of, but this doesn't, this is like most of the inquiries we have here. For example, if you look at the Iraq war inquiry, you find that an illegal act has been done, millions of people have been killed, and inquiry after inquiry finds that nobody has done anything wrong, everybody has acted honorably. So this is the kind of situation they came up with. And they said that the best thing is to say that we don't discuss that period. Imam Ali was the fourth caliph, true and right. We don't discuss the motivations of others, and Allah knows best. Full stop. And so they left the space open for any alternative narratives to flourish wherever they were, at whatever period they were. And periodically, as we will see, that basic anti-Imam Ali narrative came to the fore for other reasons in different parts of the Muslim world. So now I think it's becoming clear to you why this essential, what we discussed yesterday, which is the clear narrative, acceptable to all Muslims, was really shielded from actually becoming the dominant narrative. In parts of India and so on, in large sections of the Sunni community, that became so. And then they became critical of Muawiyah. But when this fabrication of hadith and things started, there were a number of hadiths which were fabricated, which suggested that Muawiyah was included in one of the 10 companions of the Prophet who was promised heaven. So in that sense, he could not have done anything wrong. So it continued. And it continues to this day. You will still find that being quoted in many places. And you challenge them and say, what are you talking about? And then they say, but this is the hadith, you can't say anything. And so the poison continued to brew. To give you an example of how far, of course the North African narrative was poisoned altogether, and so the Spanish narrative. But in other places as well, the poison continues to brew. And many people don't realize, especially we don't realize, because we haven't looked at the dates and the sequence of events. Two things. One is that Salahuddin Ayyubi, who is regarded as the re-conqueror of Jerusalem from the Crusaders, he suggests in his writings that his priority before attacking the enemies of Islam would be to attack the Fatimids in Egypt, because he considers them to be worse than these Christians, crusaders who have occupied Jerusalem. So you can see, even as late as 1400s, the same kind of understanding is brewing in some circles. The second thing we don't understand, and which has fueled this problem, is that Iran itself, for most of its Muslim history, was a Sunni country. It's only been Shi'i for about 500 years under the Safavids. Before that, it was a hard Sunni country. And Iran became Shi'i in a process which is quite complex and quite controversial. We don't have time to go there, but when Iran became Shi'i under the Safavids, there was another rival empire, which was the Ottoman Empire. And so the rivalry between these two now became sectarian. And the rivalry was played out in Iraq, where the Ottomans were the nominal rulers and the Safavids were trying to champion the cause of the Shi'i people of Kufa and Najaf, south of Iraq, basically. So this, for a long time, led to also extreme narratives on both sides now. Now it started to change. It wasn't one-sided now. Now it's extreme narratives on both sides, blaming each other and bringing sources and resources and rewriting resources, reinterpreting resources, which were essentially now going back and putting motives on people which may not have been there, especially in the early days of Islam. So when this continued, this also had a spillover effect into India. Now, again, it requires a little bit of understanding of history to see that Mughal India, the main language of Mughal India, the main language of culture, of governance, and so on, was Persian. And in fact, if you want to really study Mughal history, very little you can do without reference to Persian sources there. And as we said, in the beginning when the Mughals came, the Persians were Sunnis. And then they became Shia. And so this conflict was transferred into India as well. And we see the difference between the Indian Muslims in terms of division between Shi'i and Sunni. And we see this, that especially in the states of Awadh and so on, we had some Shia Maharajas and so on, or the, you know, the Nawab or the rulers of those places, but the majority were Sunnis. And in fact, in Mughal courts we see the conflict. Now when the conflict actually became more sharp was during the time of Aurangzeb. Aurangzeb, you know that Mughal rule really was based on a very, very loose interpretation of Islam. If you go to the time of Akbar, for example, everything and anything went, as long as you were, you know, politically allied to the king, there wasn't any problem. And you had the development of this idea that all religions were, you know, from Allah and so on, and then you should be tolerating. This continued until the time of Aurangzeb. In the time of Aurangzeb, people influenced by the Ottoman narrative came to him and said, look, really, all these people are not Muslims. We need to sort out ourselves. And they said, we should start. The first people who should be sorted out are the Shia, because they are a bigger problem than anybody else. So Aurangzeb started a fight against the Shia Nawabs and the Shia rulers of the south and so on, and really divided the community. But in that, you can see now the narrative, historic narrative, changing because of this big conflict and lots of prejudices being embedded in their minds. And after that, Aurangzeb went for the Hindu rulers and the Sikh rulers and so on. And by the time he had finished, the Mughal Empire was so weakened that it only needed the British to come and push a little bit, even through an East India Company, to take over the whole of India. Can you imagine that 700 years of Mughal rule was just gone because of this conflict? But from our point of view, and I think yesterday's question by Dr. Nizar was quite pertinent, that why is this narrative not accepted? There are several strands of explanation which tell you how the true narrative has been superseded by other events which came through in North Africa and so on because of the Umayyads this side, in the central parts of Islam because of the Safavi-Ottoman conflict, and then in India and so on because of these developments of this nature. And there are large areas which are untouched by this. If you go to Indonesia and Malaysia, they are untouched by this narrative altogether. Just like Nigeria, they have very little inclination of what happened. And they think, they don't think or look at it as an important event, because that's not how they are taught. They are taught not to examine the history of the first 50, 60 years after the Prophet. Everybody was good, and so we must accept that everybody is good and finished. Forget about it. Otherwise, lots of theological complications come. And when, as I said yesterday, when Maulana Maududi wrote his book, Khilafat wa Bulukiyat, hundreds of fatwas were issued against him that he has become a Shi'i. And more derogatory than that, that he has become a Rafizi, which was a derogatory term for Shi'is. So I think that's where we are in the process of understanding how the event of Karbala changed and preserved a narrative which was authentic of the Prophet's message, but how events since then have not really still reached their full potential in terms of, you know, actually understanding that really something wrong had happened here, and the people who had wronged need to be discredited in history. They could not be revered. This is the main thing if you want to get onto the path. And in this process, there's also the entry of people like Ibn Taymiyyah and so on, who really put forward an idea which is quite strange. They said that anybody who really takes power needs to be respected as the caliph, despite, regardless of their qualifications. Essentially bringing an Umayyad narrative into a theological context. And just one more development, slightly more complicated, is that during Abbasid times, there was a development of what is called rational philosophy, or the Mu'tazili idea. Now you can see that if you look at it in this context, before long, rational philosophers will uncover this nonsense at the heart of this narrative and come up with, say, well, this doesn't make sense. How can everybody be right and nobody be wrong and then everybody be wrong? This is not possible. So let's narrow down to what happened. This rational or pro-rational philosophy was challenged by an alternative philosophy called the Ash'ari, which said that everything is ordained by Allah and you just get on with it. And with a lot of promotion by the Abbasids themselves, the Ash'aris triumphed. And in fact, the Mu'tazilas were more or less eliminated from the scene, just periodically emerging. But it was an important event in suppressing the true narrative, the true import and meaning of Kabbalah throughout this age. Now finally, to end here, we want to see, as I said, this idea of the mourning ceremonies or majalis we have has originated in a particular milieu where there wasn't any possibility of having this message spread. And so it was a way out, very ingenious way out to really get there. We're in a very similar situation today, that the dominant Wahhabi narrative is again trying to suppress the events of Karbala altogether. They do not want that, because they understand that that's going to challenge. And we have to, in order to contextualize and really make Muharram more meaningful, find another way to reach out to the wider Muslim community that this is the true narrative of Muharram. And if they get that, they don't have to be Shi'is. If they get that, we can find a wider basis for understanding of this Islam and also subverting the Wahhabi narrative, which is one of the more difficult and deadly poisons across the Muslim world. Just to give you an idea, for 1400 years, everybody in Urdu has been saying, when people leave each other, they have been saying Khuda Hafiz, right? Quite normal, although it is originally Persian. But this is, if you look at, examine yourself, you see that from very young to now, it is a very standard thing you say when you say Khuda Hafiz, yeah? Suddenly you see that in the last 10-15 years, there's a group of people who start saying Allah Hafiz. You say, what's the problem here? Why? I mean, what's wrong with Khuda? I think, no, Khuda is Persian. So, does it not mean God, as you understand it, or Allah? So no, it's better to say Allah Hafiz. So you see now how this Wahhabi narrative, which has also become anti-Persian in that sense, has started to transform their mindset and touch people who would not normally essentially be in that frame of mind. But now they say, no, we must say Allah Hafiz. I say, what are you talking about? 1400 years, where were you sleeping? Suddenly today you are talking about this. In this transformation, there is also an idea which was a standard idea from Saddam Hussein, that really Shi'ism was a Persian religion. It was nothing to do with Arabs. And so during his time, from 1975 to 1982, before the war started. He had expelled a large number of Iraqis across the border to Iran on the pretext that they were Persian infiltrators. These were Iraqis, fool. Even today, somebody of the stature of Muhammad Asad, in his Road to Makkah, writes that really Shiism is a Persian flavor of Islam. So trying to say that these Persians are really just different from the others. The narrative, true as we know, is that Persia was never Shia until the last 500 years. It was the Iraqis of Kufa and Basra and Najaf who were the original Shia. And today, when you find that the Iraqis are saying that 60% plus of the Iraqi people are Shia, the whole of the Arab world is in psychological trauma. Because they say, we thought only Persians were Shia. Who are these now? Where is this Arab Shia coming from? And Iraq, in an Arab context, is a powerful country, both in terms of resource and population and so on. So when an Iraqi prime minister now goes to an Arab League meeting as a Shia prime minister, somebody who has been brought up with a history that these people, there were no Arab Shia, apart from a few here and there, gets totally disoriented. That narrative has to be corrected. So really we have to find a way in which to really rethink how we will deliver this message of Imam Hussein's movement to an audience which has 1400 years of baggage. Although it has all the capabilities to understand the true message, because nothing we are saying is outside the actual texts. And this is a challenge which I think our younger friends here should be thinking very carefully, because going through a traditional mourning ceremony outside its context, it's fine, but it doesn't take you very far. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much. We have some time for question and answers. So.
Well, thanks once again. In the current milieu of informatics and rapidly accessible informatics, do you want to postulate in 50 years' time what will be the scenario as far as the true narrative is concerned, and how would the larger Muslim Ummah respond?
See, there are some first of all, it's very difficult to see what will be there in 50 years. Yeah, if you look at 50 years back, when we were born or young, we couldn't imagine the kind of information flows which we are seeing today. Yeah, so many things can happen in 50 years which we find it difficult to see forward. But there are things which give us an inclination of what can happen. When the revolution happened in Iran, and I'm talking about the first few years, you could see that in large parts of the whole Muslim world, lots of people felt that this is the true implementation of a prophetic or follower of the Prophet. Whether they knew him or they didn't know, people felt that Imam Khomeini represented something which they could identify with as Islamic. From Nigeria to South Africa to Caribbean to wherever you went, you will see. And in those years, I had the opportunity to go to South Africa, and at that time it was under apartheid, so we went to some of these black townships like Soweto and so on. And there were only two things which you would notice in Soweto at that time. One was a refrigerator with the label of Coca-Cola on top. So that had become quite universalized. But in every house, Muslim or non-Muslim, you would see a photograph of Imam Khomeini. Now, for different reasons, different people identified with it, but large numbers of Sunnis definitely identified with it. And it's very strange that at some point, when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran in the war, the Sunni scholars, many of them, felt very threatened that the Muslim people will not identify with Saddam. So I was in a meeting in Algeria where they had, and Algerians used to have a once a year conference on Islam and Muslim culture and so on. And this conference was well attended by young Algerians. On the platform there, addressing them, you had the top 10 Sunni scholars of the time, people like Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi, Muhammad Ghazali, Abdurrahman Bhuti, and this and that, all kinds of people whom, if you know that space, you see that they are, or they were at that time, some of the top leaders. And they were saying to the audience, this is a young Algerian audience which is beginning to, you know, just before the Algerian uprising and Islamic uprising, were saying that, look, as Sunnis, we have to support Saddam Hussein, because he is the last barrier to Shi'is taking over the whole world, Muslim world. These are top scholars. These are not, you know, people on the street. And the young Algerian people were saying to them, if this is Sunnism, we don't want to be Sunnis. The whole conference is in mayhem because the young people are saying that if you are saying as top scholars that this is what Sunnism is, we are sorry. We can't identify with that. So you see what is happening here, yeah? So that's the issue. Now, in terms of your question of informatics, now how this kind of universal sentiments, and there are lots of Sunni scholars now, they say as soon as you examine the resources and you open that closed book, you find that you have to take sides. You can't say that Muawiyah was right and Imam Ali was right. This is just not feasible. And you start to take sides and you say that if Imam Ali is universally accepted and Muawiyah is not, then it is clear who is wrong. And you go further and before long you destroy that whole narrative. So really we have to find ways of engaging in that narrative which doesn't offend the audience. It educates them and informs them. How we use that through the developing information channels and so on is a challenge I can't really... At the moment, I haven't thought through, but I am just thinking through that the function of the Muharram commemoration has to change if you really want to embed that narrative, true narrative, into the Muslim community at large.
I'll take a question from the lady's side.
Bye-bye. First of all, an excellent interpretation. Now, don't you think? I think you'll all agree that the explanation and the philosophy of Imam Hussein was very clearly expressed in these three lectures of yours. Thank you very much. One thing I find difficult to understand is that whilst I understand the Shia philosophy, why should I condemn the Sunni philosophy, and why should they have done a lot to spread Islam? They have done on the whole, the Muslim world is respected because of the spread of Islam. So why should we condemn them? We can follow what we are entitled to, but why should we condemn Sunni? Don't you agree that there are enough scholars in Sunni who also have some good ideas? I agree with the Wahhabi philosophy is extreme, but otherwise I think we have to accept that the Sunni philosophy does exist and it's a way of life.
Yeah, so I think if you follow the underlying theme as to what I'm saying, I am saying exactly the same thing, that really, especially as far as the Karbala narrative is concerned, there is no need to antagonize or condemn anything. Everything is clear. A majority of Sunnis can look at events in a very similar fashion to ours without having to, you know, change their ideas or anything. It is very clear. What we need to do is to try to see how we can engage with them to, you know, come to a better understanding of the same events and saying that, look, something very disastrous happened. And the basis of that was to try to see that leadership of a Muslim community should always come to somebody from the basis of piety, not on lineage. I don't think any Sunnis will disagree with that. It's that when other people like these Wahhabis try to mobilize them on a different channel and create mayhem, that if we are clever, jointly we can defeat them with the Sunnis. We don't. But if we are silly, then we will only create bloodshed and carnage. No, you are absolutely right. I don't think there is any source in saying that everything you did is wrong, and so if only you had left it to us, we would have done it. This is all, you know, wishful thinking. And a lot of spread, of course, came from there. And if you look at in the shikwa of Allama Iqbal, you see this quite clearly, that I think it's in Jawab-e-Shikwa actually. He said, "Yun to Mirza bhi ho, Sayyid bhi ho, kya kya ho. Lekin batao Musalman bhi to ho ya nahi." Yeah. So you are saying that ekisaf mein khade hoge, Mahmood aur Ayaz, na koi banda raha, na koi banda nawaz. We all of us became one and we went forward. Okay, but in the Jawab he says, yes, but now you have become Sayyids and Mirzas and this and that, but are any of you remaining Muslims? Now here he clearly puts forward the idea that really you don't have to be a Shia or a Sunni or anything. And you see that some of his couplets in the praise of Ahlul Bayt and so on, or even in the phrase praise of Janami Fatima alayhi salam, are exemplary. But he's not a Shia. He is a Sunni philosopher and poet. So it is possible to reach there without necessarily becoming a Shia. And you are absolutely right that one of the dangers of flaming this, and this has come from Safavi Iran originally because of its antagonism with Ottomans. Just to give you an example, and this is something which is very important. In the narrative of Mukhtar, they capture and kill a person called Omar ibn al-As, because he was one of the commanders in Karbala. And we commemorate it as Eid Zehra, that this is the vindication of the capture and revenge for the killer of her son. In Safavi Iran, this Umar ibn As is transformed into the second Caliph Umar, and they start to condemn Umar al-Khattab. And now if you ask in Iran, so many people, they think the two are the same, and so in India and so on. Now when you go there, you are really opening up a whole new antagonism, which is of a different order than this. So really it's quite important to understand that if you are looking at a common narrative, you can't embellish it with other things which you have in your baggage.